Om Jesus, Om Babaji, Om Lahiri Mahashay, Om Sri Yukteswarji, Om Master, Om Mother, Saints and Sages of all religions, we bow to all of you. Free our lives from all obstacles and give us physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make our minds thy temple. Make our hearts thy altar. Make our love thy home. Thou art the only King, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Om. Om. Amen. How much joy it is to come together, focus upon our path of self-realization, of living the life. My heart overflows with it. So thank you for joining us. From the posting this morning, perhaps I should be like the TV personalities that will say, that can be seen at yogashariadavid.com. And the beautiful picture, the Dome of the Rock Shrine in Jerusalem, where it is said that Muhammad ascended to heaven. And it begins with a quote from Swami Ramdas. Spiritual progress does not mean development only in one aspect of a human being. His emotional, intellectual, and dynamic nature should evolve simultaneously. It is rightly said, karma is the foundation, jnana the upper structure, and the dome at the top is bhakti. Papa says so much in language that is easily understood by sincere aspirants. It is a gift of his spiritual genius. However, we may benefit from contemplating what Papa writes here and expand on how we can apply it in daily life. Great masters such as Swami Ramdas like for us to live a balanced life. Papa and others, such as the Buddha, experience intense sadhana or spiritual practice in order to realize the great truth. Upon attaining the same supreme state of realization, they are then in a position to say what is essential in their journey and what was either not essential to their attaining realization or is not universally necessary for all aspirants and therefore need not be duplicated. Buddha articulated the middle path, which was not what he practiced, but it was what he prescribed to all who followed his teachings to attain nirvana. Papa also went through extreme practices, but after attaining sahaja samadhi, said that others need not be so austere. Papa goes on to verbally paint a picture in the above writing that karma yoga is the foundation for spiritual living. Karma means action. It is what you do physically in life. You are to live a life of purity, starting with eating healthy foods in moderation, not with avarice. You work and do all in the spirit of service to God and others, not for greed. And all that you speak is in concert with the highest truth you know. Do not lie. In your spiritual quest, you build the foundation of your spiritual life with actions that match what you know to be the highest light. When Papa says the intellectual builds the upper structure of spiritual practice, he is not speaking here of gaining additional facts, reading books for knowledge, or any other type of what you would normally think of as intellectual endeavors. Jnana means wisdom. And more specifically, discrimination. Is your spiritual practice? You must make choices along the way. The higher up you go, the ladder of consciousness, the more discernment you need. Krishna said that extraordinary powers are pitfalls for real aspirants. Mother taught us to keep your mind on God. A statement so plain that you may not comprehend its full significance until you are well along on the path. Keeping your mind on God translates into not getting seduced by sex, greed, power, name or fame, or the many other traps that present themselves to you as you ascend the spinal stairway. Discernment is absolutely necessary as you build a life upwards, knowing that you must have a solid foundation and a well-constructed upper stories to prepare yourself to succeed in the great quest. Bhakti, intense love and attraction for attaining the supreme state of God realization, makes the dome of your temple of spiritual practice, that which caps the life, spiritual life, with success. The drawing power of love is required for the kind of complete self-surrender that is necessary to be subsumed in divine consciousness. There is no greater power in all of creation than love. It makes you want to be absorbed in your beloved and lose yourself in him. Physical activity done in service and practice of wise discernment by themselves are not enough to take you all the way. When lifted up into the highest centers of consciousness, you focus on one thing, the goal of goals, consummation in samadhi by ultimate love. Divine union is the consequence of this total surrender, and leaves behind all spiritual practices when lover and beloved merge and become one. Building your spiritual temple by constructing a solid foundation, intelligently designed frames for the upper structure, and a brilliantly radiating dome in your daily life is a wonderful thing. It shows you what is needed in order to realize God. But knowing the way and being immersed in the supreme reality is not the same thing. Be inspired by these beautiful teachings from Papa. Take the complete plunge into spiritual life with total enthusiasm. Be absorbed into the infinite beloved who dwells beyond time and space and all form. Realize the truth, even as the Buddha, Papa, and Mother so fully immerse themselves in the highest reality, and then help others to build their own temples of spiritual practice with nothing but the very finest materials. We are such beneficiaries to have Papa and Master and the great gurus. Where would we be without their most perfect wisdom to help us direct the mind so that we might attain that goal of goals? I'd like to read from St. Teresa of Avila, chapter 10. Once we have detached ourselves from the world and from our kinsfolk, we are cloistered here. She is writing here to her sisters living in the monastery. In the conditions already described, it must look as if we have done everything and there is nothing left with which we have to contend. But, oh, my sisters, do not feel secure and fall asleep, for you'll be like a man who goes to bed quite peacefully after bolting all his doors for fear of thieves, and the thieves are already in the house. And you know there is no worse thief than the one who lives in the house. We ourselves are always the same, unless we take great care, and each of us looks well to do that which she renounces of her self-will, which is the most important of all. There will be many things to deprive us of the holy freedom of spirit which our souls seek in order to soar to their Maker, unburdened by the leaden weight of the earth. It will be a great help towards this if we keep constantly in our thoughts the vanity of all things and the rapidity which with they pass away, so that we may withdraw our affections from things that are so trivial and fix them upon that which will never come to an end. This may seem a poor kind of help, but it will have the effect of greatly fortifying the soul. With regard to small things, we must be very careful, as soon as we begin to grow fond of them, to withdraw our thoughts from them and turn them to God. His Majesty will help us to do this. He has granted us the greatest favor of providing that. In this house, most of it is already done. But it remains for us to become detached from our own selves, and it is a hard thing to withdraw from ourselves and oppose ourselves, because we are very close to ourselves and love ourselves very dearly. It is here that true humility can enter. For this virtue and that of detachment from self, I think, always go together. They are two sisters who are inseparable. That is humility and detachment. These are not the kinsfolk whom I counsel you to avoid. No, you must embrace them and love them and never be seen without them. Oh, how sovereign are these virtues! Mistresses of all created things, empresses of the world, our deliverers from the snares and the entanglements laid by the devil, so dearly loved by our dear teacher, Christ, who was never for a moment without them. He that possesses them can go safely out and fight all the united forces of hell and the whole world and its temptations. Let him fear none, for his is the kingdom of heaven. There is none whom he need fear, for he cares nothing if he loses everything, nor does he count this as a loss. His sole fear is that he may displease his God, and he begs him to nourish these virtues within him, lest he lose them through any fault of his own. These virtues, it is true, have the property of hiding themselves from one who possesses them, in such a way that he never sees them, nor can he believe that he has any of them, even if he be told so. But he esteems them so much that he is forever trying to obtain them, and thus he perfects them in himself more and more. And those who possess them soon make the fact clear, even against their will, to any with whom they have intercourse. But how inappropriate it is for a person like myself to begin to praise humility and detachment, when these virtues are so highly praised by the King of Glory, appraised exemplified in all of the trials he suffered. It is to possess these virtues, then, my daughters, that you must labor if you would leave the lands of Egypt, for when you have obtained them, you will also obtain manna. All things will taste well to you, and however much the world may dislike their Savior, to you they will be sweet. And it is true, detachment and humility are two wonderful virtues and absolutely essential to us on the path. Humility is an interesting one, because true humility is that complete and total surrender to God. And as Mother pointed out through one of her stories once, that she was talking to a very great saint in India, and she said God had quite an ego that day, and she was talking herself up as God was directing her. And finally the saint pronounced to Mother, and he said, "Mother, we must remember to be humble." And then she went on to explain to the saint to take him above saint consciousness, that true humility is being totally surrendered to God. And even if God were to look egotistical through you, that you would surrender to that, and that you would allow him to act as he would. You see, in order to get complete God realization, we must go above good and evil. Those whom Mother talked about having saint consciousness were wedded to good and abhorred evil. But those who have arisen above both and all duality, realize that God is the sole creator in all the three universes, and that with Him, and with Him as the guide, solely at the helm, He may look in any way that He chooses to do. He may use you to look like the oppositional force in one case, and for another, He may make you look like you are ignorant, like you do not know anything at all. It is all His play, you see. It is all the ways that He chooses to act through you. And if there is any place of attachment inside of you, God will find it out, and He will work to root it out by giving to you what you need. I spent a previous lifetime quite proud of my intellect. And so, God explained it to me. I came into this earth, and my memory is not always what it should be. And I don't always have an intellect. He takes it away from me completely. And through the spiritual experiences that I've had, I've realized that the intellect is very inferior to the intelligence of God. We would like to equate the two as being one. But human intellect, the human mind, as Swami Satchidananda called it, the puny human mind, is just that. It is puny. Now, we depend on it in this world to do many things, and without it, we can be in some real trouble. And fortunately, God has always looked after me, and if He took away my mind, He gave me somebody in my life who could help fill in the gaps. Because it is true, there has been times when I've had no mind at all. None. And through that experience, I let go of any thought of superiority because of intellect. It is a poor substitute for the purity of God and the intelligence of God. Just look around you. Look at this earth. Look at this creation. These are all reflected aspects of God. They are not even the absolute pure aspect of God. They're reflected. And yet, the intelligence that we see that has gone into the design of everything that we see, anything from an atom, even an electron, even subatomic particles, a quark or a quasar, all the way up to the cosmos, and seeing wonderful explosions and diversity and creations going on all throughout the universe. I was so amazed once when I saw a Hubble photograph of the stars. And they drew a square, it was not even a huge square, that had so many dots of little lights. And in that square, it is said, each one represents a galaxy. Not just a star, but millions of stars, each point of light does. Isn't that amazing? We live in this tremendous creation. And yet we walk around like little worms. We're so concerned with everything that affects us in a personal way. We're so concerned whether we'll gain something or whether we'll lose something. It consumes us. And yet, right within us, we are told by all the great masters of all the different religions that God Himself exists right within us, the Creator, the intelligence that went into all of this creation, the power of it. Everything is right within us. And that if we seek it out, if we look to explore it, come to know it, that we could be transformed and changed into its likeness and its image. This is a marvelous, marvelous promise. And you would think that all the people who pile into a football stadium or pay a lot to go to a concert and listen to some music, how much they love their sports, how much they love their music, or whatever it is that they have a certain passion for. And to think that that passion that they have for a certain aspect is an aspect of God. A tiny, minuscule part, the most beautiful music in the world, the most exciting rush of some extreme sport. And it's just a tiny little subset of what God is. By definition, everything in life is God. And therefore, it can only be a little element of God. And yet, we do not seek out the sole creator. We do not plug ourselves directly in to that which has been the power of this entire universe, and yet is it available to us, and we can have it safely when looking inside and seeing the third eye. I have seen such a brilliant light. It has been described in some of the scriptures like 10,000 suns all at once, and yet it does not burn your eyes. It does not hurt you in any way. Rather, your mind expands with that light. You merge with it. You become one with it. And it is a most beautiful experience to have. And not just once, but many times. And you can go inside. And at first you see perhaps just darkness. So you have to stick with it. You have to keep going. And it is here that discernment helps you. Because many different images will come to you. And if we are to rise up into the superstructure of the temple, then we must show that discernment. We must put aside the different images that come. There can be things, revelations, that come as truth. And it is the truth. And yet, once again, it is just a tiny little subset of what God is. And it can come in the most simple, most elegant kinds of ways that you try to put into words. And when you put it into words, it sounds like many other words that we've heard. That God is everywhere. I remember when a devotee came to me once and said, was telling me about a vision that they had. And that they really saw God is everywhere. And then they said, "Why didn't you tell me this? Well, I know that you told me this, but why didn't you tell me it? Why didn't you get it to me? This is so incredible, so remarkable." And it is the way that we feel because we use the same words that we have always used, and yet they take on brand new meaning. They become alive. They are potent with meaning. And this is the way realization comes. It is not that it is something so brand new that you've never heard it before. Sometimes that's the case too. But usually it's an affirmation of what you have already known, what you have already said, but you have not yet realized it. This is the power of realization. It comes on you so terrifically. It lifts you up. It purifies you. And suddenly you see the world in a brand new way. And yet, the world has not changed, and in one aspect, you have not changed. Papa used to say to people who came to the ashram, when perhaps they expressed some disappointment that who he was and how he presented himself, and he says, "What, do people expect me to have horns? Do they expect me to have something so extraordinary that you would not be able to miss it?" You think about Jesus in his life, and he could wander as anybody else could. Nobody would notice the difference. Relatives saw him as a dear one, but just simply a relative. There were those who had known him all of their life, and when his own mother and brethren approached him, he said, "Who are my brothers, who are my sisters, but those who do the will of my Father?" You see, you can live this life in a very ordinary kind of a way. And yet, your vision, your state of realization, has completely transformed and changed you into a new being. So this is the way that we build this temple. We do it with those actions that are in concert with the highest light, with the highest truth that we know. We have read about and known about different spiritual teachers who have not lived what they have taught. And as a result of that, they hurt the faith of the people who have come to them in order to learn the truth. Now, it is true that even the Christ fell three times on his way up to the hill of Golgotha, or the hill of the skull. And so it may come that despite our best efforts, well, perhaps it's not our best efforts, because we may fall, we may have a slip, and we may do something that goes against the very principles that we espouse, that we say that we believe in, and that we want for in our lives. And the thing is this, it is as if you go on to a diet, and you're eating very well, and you're feeling good about yourself, and then suddenly you have a bad day, and you eat all of the wrong kinds of foods, and way too much of it. And then what do? Do you throw the diet away? Or do you get right back on with a lesson well learned? You look at what took you into the field of temptation, and then you correct yourself. You self-correct. And this is the way the true devotees do. They're aspiring for God. They're doing all the things that they know to do. And then some temptation comes along. Now, we can read all of the stories, and when the stories talk about somebody not making the right decision, we think, well, of course, I know what the right thing to do is there. But when it comes to our own lives, it touches us deeply. It goes right to the heart of our attachment. And so to practice this detachment, as St. Teresa talked about, is absolutely essential. It has to be something that is with us always. And yet, there may come a time when we don't live up to our own standards and to those that we feel God has for us. And so do we just fall off the wagon then? Or do we self-correct? Do we get right back on and start striving for truth once again? You see, if you just go with it, you are being swept downstream and taken downhill as well. And you will fall a very, very great ways before you wake up, before you are in such pain once again, that you know that the only solution is to seek out God. Only now you have gone so far away from God. And so you have to take step by step by step, every step that you have lost ground on, and go back towards God. And it's not an easy thing to do. But it is in this way that we learn wisdom. And the greatest wisdom is to not get delayed, not get sidetracked. It's a wonderful story of a king who had no children. And so he decided one time that he would test all of his ministers, those who surrounded him who were in office, because he was going to select from one of them who should be the next king. And so he asked them all to come to the palace on a certain day. And on that day, he created, in the most wily kind of a way, all these wonderful kinds of events and fairs and everything that he could think of that would tempt any of these ministers. And they started off in a group, but one by one they started to peel off as they saw something that attracted them, and they really couldn't just pass by. There was his chief prime minister, however, and the king had called him, and he did not look to the left, and he did not look to the right. He went straight to the palace, and then he just humbly came over and he sat down in front of the king, and he waited, and he was going to wait for all the other ministers to come, for it was only then that the king would start to speak. And over many hours, and in some cases days, it took for the ministers to draggle themselves in one by one, and they all looked a little worse for the wear. And the king said, "Now, you can be in no doubt whom I'm going to select as my replacement and why." And they all hung their heads down in a little bit of shame because they realized that they had not passed the test. But they knew the dedication, the one-pointedness of the prime minister. And as a result of that, They knew that he was the one that the king would select. That's a wonderful story. And it is something that, if we pay attention to, we can really go to work on ourselves and become just like that prime minister. Papa then talks about the dome of the temple, which is love for God. And why is love so important? It is because it is the most powerful attractive force. We can practice discernment. God is not this, God is not that. But it doesn't give us that attractive power, that thing that makes God more important to us than anything else in the world. To have that state of realization, we know that we cannot live without it. And I thought I would read to you a few stories from Ramakrishna about this kind of love. And this one starts out that a Brahmin used to worship his family deity with food offerings. One day he had to go away on business. As he was about to leave the house, he said to his son, "Give this offering to the deity today. See that God is fed." The boy offered food in the shrine, but the image remained silent on the altar. It would neither eat nor talk. The boy waited a long time, but still the image did not move. But the boy firmly believed that God would come down from his throne, sit on the floor, and partake of his food. Again and again he prayed to the deity, saying, "O Lord, come down and eat the food. It is already very late. I cannot sit here any longer." But the image did not utter a word. The boy burst into tears and cried, "O Lord, my father asked me to feed you. Why won't you come down? Why don't you eat from my hands?" The boy wept for some time with a longing soul. At last the deity, smiling, came down from the altar and sat before the meal and ate it. After feeding the deity, the boy came out of the shrine room. His relative said, "The worship is over. Now bring away the offering." You see, it is prasad. That is the tradition. "Yes," said the boy, "the worship is over, but God has eaten everything." "How is that?" asked the relatives. The boy replied innocently, "Why, God has eaten the food." They entered the shrine and were speechless with wonder to see the deity had really eaten every bit of the offering. And it reminds me of when I was with Swamiji and we fed Ganesha, the wooden statue, tried to feed him the milk out of a spoon, but when he didn't take, then Swamiji said, "I guess he's not taking today." With such childlike faith and love did Swamiji have. And another story. Once there is an anaprasan ceremony in the guru's house, that is, the feeding of rice for the child that is newborn. His disciples volunteered according to their powers to supply different articles of food. He had one disciple, a very poor widow, who owned a cow. She milked it and brought the guru a jar of milk. He had thought she would take charge of all the milk and curd for the festival. Angry at her poor offering, he threw the milk away and said to her, "Go down and drown yourself." The widow accepted this as his command and went down to the river to drown herself. But God was pleased with her guileless faith and, appearing before her, said, "Take this pot of curd. You will never be able to empty it. The more curd you pour out, the more will come into your pot. This will satisfy your teacher." The guru was then speechless with amazement when the pot was given to him. After hearing from the widow the story of the pot, he went down to the river, saying to her, "I shall drown myself if you cannot show God to me." God appeared then and there, but the guru could not see him. Addressing God, the widow said, "If my teacher gives up his body because thou hast not revealed thyself to him, then I too shall die." So God appeared to the guru, but only once. And the last one. A certain person, on coming across a sadhu, humbly begged him for instruction. The sadhu's advice was, Love God with all of your heart and your soul. The inquirer replied, I have never seen God, nor do I know anything about him. How is it possible that I should love him? Haven't we thought of that sometimes? We hear Mother and Master and others talking about love of God. But if we don't know God, then how can we love him? The holy man inquired whom the other loved most. The answer was, I have nobody to care for. I have a sheep, and that is the only creature I love. The sadhu said, then tend the creature and love it with all of your heart and soul, and always remember that the Lord abides in it. Having given this advice, the sadhu left the place. The inquirer now began to tend the sheep with loving care, fully believing that the Lord abode in the creature. After a long time, the sadhu, during his return journey, sought out the person he had advised and inquired how he was getting on. The latter saluted the sadhu and said, Master, I am all right thanks to your kind instructions. Much good has come to me by following the line of thought you prescribed. Time and again I see the beautiful figure of Vishnu deep within the sheep, and I find supreme bliss in that. In each of these cases, these were not sophisticated souls who loved God, the boy who went to feed God the food, and that God came down and took it, or the lady with the simple faith went down at her guru's instructions to kill herself, and yet God intervened. These are simple souls, but they have open hearts. They have hearts full of love for God. And even as in the last case, the shepherd, who didn't have anyone special in his life except for his sheep, there by serving his sheep and always reminding himself that God was present in the sheep, God revealed himself. God revealed himself. And so it is in our souls. We can be very sophisticated in life. We can have all the intellectual reasons all worked out in our minds. We can have memorized many passages out of the Bible and yet not have love in our hearts. This is in the time of Jesus, as he pointed out on occasions, and it is the time now. Let us not be proud of intellect or other accomplishments or wealth or anything else. We are all equal before God. We are all equal. And when we appear before God, what does it matter to him whether we have gold or whether we have wealth or fame or anything else? They are all tiny little trinkets to him. What he treasures, what he loves most, is the soul who loves him, for he can pour himself into that soul. He can purify him and make him a living agent of the Lord's here on earth. You see, God loves that. He is like a fine craftsman who has found a tool that can do exactly what it is that he wants to do through them. And if that tool is stubborn, if it has a mind of its own, if it only wants what it only wants, then he will set that tool aside. There's a wonderful story of the two stones. And they were side by side in the temple. Only one of the stones was one of the steps that was going up to the statue, the image of God. And the other stone was the image itself. Late one night, when everything was very quiet and there were no pilgrims about, the stone steps started talking to the stone statue. And he said, hey, you up there. He said, we are made of the same stuff. We're exactly the same kind of stone. And yet people just trample on me and pay no attention to me at all on their way to you. And to you, they bow down to, They put sandal paste on you, crown you with flowers, do everything with such loving attention and detail. Why is this? The stone statue, the image of God, replied, "Well, the master carver started on you at first, but you didn't like the strikes and the blows that he was giving you as he started to chisel on you. And you cried out, and you resisted, and you put up such a fuss that eventually he set you aside. And then he went to work on me. And he started to chisel away, and I didn't like it. It was painful. It was difficult. And yet he kept going, and I thought, he must have some purpose in doing this, for he is a master carver. Gradually, gradually, he chipped away and chipped away all the dross until what was revealed was the living God inside of the stone. That image was always inside of the stone, but it took the master carver his ability, his effort, to be able to take away everything that was not God in order to reveal the image of God. And that is why I am up here and you are down there." And it gave something for the stone step to think about, I can tell you. So let us take these lessons to heart. I have one thing to read that was sent by Rebecca Harvey. As she's going through, she's doing a lot of work for us around Mother's Talks. And so once in a while, when she is very moved by something, she'll send it to me. And it's always wonderful to receive. And this one starts out, "Hari Om, I just listened to Mother read this poem over and over again. It is so heart-achingly beautiful. I had to share it with you. Sending you so much love, joyful pranams, and 1,000 hugs. Rebecca." And then this is Mother introducing Master's talk, or his writing. "I'd like to read to you from Master's writing this evening. This one is entitled, When Will He Come? All of us on the path are constantly wondering when God will come to us. We meditate upon Him, we serve Him, we love Him, and we constantly, it is the cry of our hearts, Lord, when will you come? So Master answers this question. When every heart's desire pales itself before the brilliancy of the ever-leaping flames of God-love, then He will come. When the faggots of all desires you fearlessly, grieflessly, joylessly are ever ready to burn in the fireplace of life, in expectation of His coming, then you may keep Him from your freezing inner indifference. Then He will come. When no inclination or unfulfilled craving can be sure of your stability to them. When He shall be sure that you shall never leave the Guru, then He will come. No matter how you feel, helpless, forsaken, in torture of temptation, karma, or tests, if you ever keep hoping He will come, He will come. When your mind says piercingly, you can't, you don't deserve having Him. Still, if your soul, disregarding all this, shall ever keep chanting within, He will come, then He will come. When He shall be sure nothing else can get to you, then He will come. Even if you are the sinner of sinners, still, if you never stop calling Him deeply in the temple of unceasing love, then He will come." And Mother ends, "That is very, very beautiful." And so, of course, we have here Master echoing what Papa said. Love is the capstone upon which your divine efforts find fulfillment. Because love has the power to draw God. He cannot resist you when you are sincere, when you will not give up. He must come to you. He is helpless against your calls. So let us live these three different stages of sadhana all in equal balance, Let our actions reflect the highest light in us. Let us also practice discernment and not give in to the things we should not, and to always keep our minds focused on the things we should. And most of all, let us love God. Love God with all of your heart, with all of your mind, with all of your soul, and all of your strength, as the Master said. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like to it, love thy neighbor as thyself. Did anyone speak the truth more plainly, more perfectly, more fully in that moment? It is a wonderful thing. You see, we have heard the truth from almost the time that we were first born, but we have not put it into action. We have not really lived it, because if we had, then we would have our realization today fully and completely. So let us strive and strive and strive some more. And as Lhari Mahasaya said, one day behold the goal. But it is, as St. Teresa said, it almost creeps up on you. You are unconscious of it because you're so focused on practicing it. And then one day, perfection reveals itself in you. And you melt into its being. And you become one with that. Never to become separated ever again. This is that great temple that you are building inside of you. May it be so. May you build with integrity and love and devotion. And may God answer your soul calls so that you may realize Him fully and completely. Victory to God, victory to the light, and pronouns to you, the great light within you.